The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, Q&A edition for this week. We have, I guess you'd call this one of our special edition Q&As, where we are going to focus on tax-related issues. And for that reason, we've got, in addition to Jim joining me here in a moment, we've also got Paul, who's part of our CPA tax team, and Jake, who's an enrolled agent and also on the general planning team as well, bringing their tax thoughts to your tax-related questions today. So that's the direction we're going to head. Jake, since you've unmuted first, I'll welcome you to the show initially. Hi, Jake.
Hello, Chris, Jim, Paul, and everyone. It's great to be here again and looking forward to tackling some of these tax questions, see how many we get through.
Thanks for coming back. And Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot. I know inflation has happened. My wife and I had gone out to lunch and we stopped by this supposedly the nicest bakery in the area on the way home. And we got four items plus a few caramels and it was $42. So I know that inflation has happened.
Yeah, you're feeling it at the bakery.
Yeah, I'm feeling it at the bakery.
Yeah, I'm actually shocked. There's a couple bakeries here in town up in Northern Colorado that I have some shockingly expensive baked goods. I mean, think about the raw. I know there's an art to it, and an artist should be paid, but we're talking flour, sugar, water, yeast. I'm not sure there's much excuse for something like that costing tens of dollars.
I know. I know.
So,
a lot of labor, though. A lot of labor.
Some of it. I get it. I get it. But it just seems a little much at times, but it is, when well done, baked goods are a wonderful, joyous thing in our world. So, Jim, what do you think? You liked your baked goods? And
we did like at least the one that we tried when we got home. It was very good. And I think you're correct. The CPI index for Social Security probably understates inflation, not overstates it.
Yeah. Yeah, so Jim, would you spend $40 on a pie?
Pie? No.
Yeah.
Because I'm not a big pie eater. Now, chocolate cake with white frosting?
No,
it's possible.
The kind you like is $12.40. So there's
the kind of chocolate cake with white frosting I like is even cheaper than that. Yeah. You can get it like a 3-day old one, and they're just trying to get rid of them.
Oh, off to the side of the bakery and on those shelves.
That's right.
On the shelves with all the orange tags on it. Yeah. Yeah, I don't
shop. I do want to say, since we kind of got on the subject of inflation, I don't know how. This is just weird that you brought this up. Mm-hmm. I'm getting another spiralizer. I'm sure you guys heard of spiralizers because I like to spiralize zucchini into zucchini pasta. And I have that in lieu of spaghetti a lot. I love it. Anyways, in November of 2020, on Amazon.com, my spiralizer was $38.99. What do you think that same spiralizer is today, almost 5 years later?
Well, I personally would not have ever paid $38.99 for a spiralizer, so that seems high to me already. So I bet it's less, because that seems like overpriced.
Oh no, I'm going to guess like $58. So I'm probably still low, but I'm going to guess $48.49.76.
How does that work on The Price is Right? You have to come closest without
going over.
Then Chris is right.
Bless.
The price today, because I ordered one for my Ohio apartment. Mm-hmm. The price today, remember, I paid $38.99. Today is $39. One cent more.
Yeah. Yeah.
So inflation hasn't hit everything the same. But to Chris's point, or to someone's point about the bakeries, Blondie and I went out to lunch yesterday. Blondie, folks, is a friend of mine. I've called her Blondie for 20 plus years. She and I went out to grab some lunch before she flew to visit her father. And we stopped off at that bakery, Chris, in Old Town. That is where Bluebird used to be. And then Bluebird moved into Canino's. Mm-hmm. So there's some new bakery there. Mm-hmm. I paid $4.23 for a little muffin. And I was, no more. It's just, she wanted a muffin. I was like, okay, let's go buy a muffin for dessert. It was a good muffin, but it was not worth $4.23 for one muffin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the $40 pie thing, I've run into at two bakeries now, where an apple pie, not something, just an apple pie, they wanted $40. Oh. And I'm thinking, that just doesn't make sense. To me.
That does not make sense.
Anyway.
Means we're not charging enough for our tax returns. So.
Yeah, something.
I know.
Something. Yeah.
Anyway. All righty. Well, let's jump into this, folks, because it's not every day that we have the taxeteers on, at least together. We're missing one of the three taxeteers, though. That would have been Steve. Mm-hmm. We should try to get Steve on someday. Y'all would like Steve. He's got a wicked, wicked East Coast accent. I think he's from Jersey, isn't he? Is he Jersey or New York?
He lives in Long Island.
Yeah,
Long Island. Okay. Long
Island, yeah. Is it in or on Long Island? I can never remember.
I don't know.
New Yorkers will correct us.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't think he wants to be called a New Jerseyan. So,
okay. Well, he likes the Jets, doesn't he? So that's. I know it's New York Jets, but they play in Jersey.
Yeah,
they just plug their nose and go there, I think.
Yeah.
Anyways, maybe one day we can get Steve on as well. And then we'll have all three taxeteers.
By the way, that wasn't a personal attack on New Jersey. I'm saying from the perspective of a New Yorker who doesn't like New Jersey, not my personal view of New Jersey. Just to be clear, that was my nose. My plugging your nose comment. After I said it, I'm like, wait a minute, that's going to sound like I have an issue with New Jersey. I personally do not. So.
Good point. We do have listeners from New Jersey.
Yeah, and next I have no problem with New Jersey. So
you'll be walking down the street and three Italian-looking men in very nice suits will be walking up to you saying, I hear you have a problem. Okay, let's get to the tax questions, folks. So I'm going to try to get through five, but we ended up getting, I think, one or two in last night. People trying to get in under the light or under the deadline or whatever the heck that saying is. So we might try to sneak those in as well if nobody has a problem. Okay, I'm trying to get these in the order that I saved them. And here is the first one. Okay. Now, this question came in last year, but I think it still will apply today. And he does give a state hint, folks, so we're going to play. Now, Chris, you can use, because we won't tell ChatGPT, in case the two taxeteers don't know, Chris is playing against ChatGPT, and the score is tied 7-7. But for this show, and I won't tell Chat, the three of you can kind of powwow together, see if you can guess these. But Chris, here is your state hint, if you are ready.
I'm ready.
Okay. This state is where Jim Davis, the creator of the cartoon character Garfield, and actor James Dean were both born.
I would have never get this. I have no idea. This is going to be a guess. Illinois.
Well, you have two other people on the show. Did you want to use the collective wisdom of the two taxateers?
Does anyone have any clue about, well, maybe, you know, James Dean, if you were a fan, you might know where he was born.
I do not.
I was a Garfield fan, but I didn't really pay attention to where the author came from.
I think you're close on the state. It does start with an I think. And I think if you were to go from Chicago and travel a little south and a little east, you might run into that state.
Yeah. Isn't it Indiana?
Is that your final answer, Chris?
Sure, let's go with Indiana.
And what was your original state?
Illinois.
Illinois. Well, that begins with an I as well. According to this gentleman, the answer is Illinois, and according to ChatGPT, I'm sorry. This gentleman did give his answer. Indiana. So Indiana is correct. Paul bailed you out, and ChatGPT said that would be Indiana again. So apparently we had an Indiana answer already because ChatGPT never forgets. Jim Davis was born in Marion, Indiana, and James Dean was also born in Marion, Indiana.
Interesting. Well, I got darn close for guess.
Yeah, I was pretty impressed.
How the hell did you know that, Paul?
That was a trivia question that I had on a when I was on a cruise ship a while back.
Interesting. Okay. It's funny how we have these little bits of tidbit information in our heads. All right, let's get to the tax question. And again, this came in last year, guys. But he says, I have a question about contributing to my traditional IRA. I am 63 and recently retired, but do take on some business consulting engagements to stay active. I know that I can make contributions equal to the lesser of $7,500 or my net self-employment income. And before I read any further, everybody on this show and listeners, these contribution limits are probably a little off. I'm just reading his email verbatim. One of the two taxateers will set things straight. I know that I can make contributions equal to the lesser of $7,500 or my net self-employment income. I expect to earn $8,000 in 2024 in gross 1099 income and will have no deductions against this amount other than the QBI deduction and a deduction for health insurance premiums. You guys can explain what QBI is. IRS Publication 590 defines contributions for IRA purposes as net earnings from your trade or business reduced by the total of the deduction for contributions made on your behalf to retirement plans and the deduction allowed for the deductible part of your self-employment taxes. That's a mouthful and confusing. Does the term net earnings include 1040 deductions for QBI and self-employment health insurance premiums for purpose of determining one's maximum traditional IRA contribution? I realize this is very nuanced and not your typical IRA question, but I'm thinking there may be others of dabbling retirees that could benefit from making IRA contributions to offset small amounts of earned income. Anything you guys want to help with? He's got a lot going on. Remember, he was 63 last year in 2024. So I think his contribution amounts are off. And basically, he's just asking, what's self-employment income and how much can he put into his IRA?
Yeah, and I think the good news is that it's not going to be reduced by the QBI deduction or the health insurance deduction. And as you mentioned, Jim, QBI stands for Qualified Business Income. It was a new deduction that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act back in 2017, or commonly referred to as the Trump tax cuts, brought about. And essentially where you have a business like his, you know, he's earning $8,000 on the business, you're allowed up to 20% deduction based on that business income. So in his case, the $8,000 would then be reduced by his 1/2 of the self-employment tax deduction, which in his case for that dollar amount would be $565. It's also reduced by his health insurance of $6,000. So that brings his income for the QBI deduction down to maybe less than $2,000. But the good news is for his retirement, the IRA contribution, that income is based only on the self-employment income, which is $8,000, minus the self-employment tax deduction, because you get to deduct 1/2 of your self-employment taxes. In this case, it's $565. So his limit is not the $8,000. It is $7,435. So he wouldn't be able to put in the full amount, but it would be the $7,435. Now, where then we'll go down a little bit of a rabbit hole. If he was to have some type of a simple or a SEP plan where he's actually participating in a retirement plan, and let's say he was able to deduct $1,500 for that, that would then reduce the amount that he could put into a IRA as far as the deduction or the amount that he could put in. And then on top of it, if his income is too high from that self-employment income and he participates in a retirement plan, then he can still put money perhaps into an IRA, but he can't deduct the IRA because of the fact that he's covered by a pension plan. So again, there's a couple little bit rabbit holes that we can go down.
Yeah, and I think that $7,500 he's talking about, that would have been the IRA contribution limit for someone over 50 in 2023. So if he sent this last year, he was off just a little bit because it had gone up by that point. And then this year, of course, it's $8,000 for everybody who's over 50. So that's where that, so I think, $7,500 piece came from.
Yeah. And the good news is when we're preparing these tax returns is we're using a computer to calculate this.
Yeah, exactly.
The only thing that I will add, and it's kind of going down a little bit of a rabbit hole, not very deep we're going to go, but it got me thinking as you guys were talking, granted he's only 63, probably 64 this year. But when he reaches 70 and a half and he's eligible for QCDs, Secure Act has changed the rules.
Yes.
And the rules now are post age 70 and a half, you can continue to make deductible contributions to IRAs. Prior to Secure Act, you couldn't. However, if you do, and you also try to do a QCD, your QCD is going to be reduced by the amount of deductible contributions you made to your IRA post 70 and a half. So do keep that
in
mind.
Yeah, that's a little rabbit hole. Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
And that's on a cumulative basis. So let's say that you had made $20,000 of deductible IRA contributions after age 70 and a half, and then you elected to do a, let's say, a $30,000 QCD. As Jim mentioned, the first $20,000 is treated as a regular taxable distribution. Obviously, you get the offsetting deduction for charitable contributions, but then the remaining $10,000 is treated as a QCD. So it's on a cumulative basis that you have to keep track of that.
Correct. So if he is going to continue to do this past age 70 and a half and wants to do QCDs, he's going to run into that issue that everything he's deducting after age 70 and a half will end up being taxable to him when he donates it to a charity.
Which might kick him into another IRMA bracket that he wasn't planning on. So you just got to be careful of those.
Yeah. Anyways, it just kind of jumped into my head as you guys were talking, and I thought, well, let me make mention of that. All right. I think that went well. Anything you want to add, Chris or Paul? Or Jake, rather?
No, I think Paul nailed it.
All righty. Perfect. All right. Next question. Did they send a hint? Oh, yes. I do have a hint. All right. Hold on. I got to get ChatGPT open, folks. Oh, first, I have to tell chat that both Chris and it were right. Both you and Chris were correct. Apparently has no comment on that, Chris, at all. Oh, he updated the score 8-8. And he says it's neck to neck and turning into a classic show. I'm glad it thinks so. All right. Here is the next hint, and feel free to use Jake and Paul for your lifeline if you'd like. Okay. Oh, I think ChatGPT will know this because it knows everything. If I give the, I'll give the hard hint and then the easy hint, and we'll see which one works for you, Chris. Okay. This state, the American foxhound is the state dog.
I don't really track the state dogs of each state, but...
I didn't even know there were state dogs.
Yeah, so I think I'm going to need the easier hint.
Okay, let me see if chat can get this on the hard hint.
Reminds me of the movie Best in Show, if you guys have ever seen that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, chat has submitted its answer. Here is the easy one, Chris. This will give it away for you. 8 presidents have been from this state, but none in the 21st century, and only one in the 20th century, which would be the 1900s. So it's got to be an old state. Oh, come on. I know you can do this. I know you're not a history buff.
I know Ohio has had a lot of presidents.
I know Ohio is usually have more recently. A good answer for these. But
I think it's going to be Virginia because, you know, you got Washington, you got Madison, you got Monroe, you got Jefferson, you got, I think even Andrew Jackson might have been born in Virginia. So I'm thinking it's Virginia. But
I was thinking the same thing because there's just so much of this type of these type of people from Ohio and Virginia. And because we're talking, you know, early on, I think I'm going to go with Paul again and Virginia. So
Virginia is correct. So you guys are doing good. Let me let chat know. Both you and Chris are correct again.
Does chat indicate who they all are? I'm just curious.
It did not. Oh, wait a minute. Because I didn't give chat that hint. I only gave it
the
American foxhound, and it did get Virginia. Chat, according to chat, the American foxhound was designated the official dog of Virginia in 1966, and the breed has deep historical roots. It was even the favored dog by George Washington.
Sure. Chris, okay. I think you're in a tough spot here moving forward. I don't know if the chat's going to get any of these wrong.
I know. So here's the 8 from Virginia. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, William Henry Harrison, John Tyler, Zachary Taylor, and Woodrow Wilson was the last one.
And so Wilson was the 20th century one.
Yep.
All right. Let's get to a actual question. I have a disabled son receiving SSI as a disabled adult, and I'm looking for the best way to fund his expenses. My wife and I have significant resources and expect our retirement pension and SSI income to pay all of our expenses. And we have significant extra income, as well as non-taxable Roth and tax-deferred assets that can be used to help my son. It sounds to me, Chris, like their unicorns. When he said all their expenses, I have to assume all of their fun and all of their minimum dignity floor. So we're dealing with what we call, folks, unicorns. Their lifetime guaranteed secure income can cover conceivably every expense they're going to have. Minimum dignity floor of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, as well as fun spending. Are you guys all in agreement? That's kind of what it sounds like in that opening paragraph.
Yes.
Certainly does.
Okay. So here's his next main question. I don't think he's going to be able to do what he wants to do, or people would be talking about this till the cows come home. But anyways, he says, we have learned that a qualified third-party disability trust is entitled, and that would be a special needs trust, folks. There can be a first party and third party. Third party is created and funded by someone else besides the disabled person. So he's saying, we have learned that a qualified third-party disability trust is entitled to a $5,000 deduction on federal taxes. We were wondering, could we set up such a trust to divide itself into whenever federal taxes are paid in the prior year. So can we have two of these trusts or 50 of these third person special needs trusts that all benefit my son? And can they all take that $5,000 federal tax deduction? Let's just assume I totally enjoy preparing and filing tax returns, or at least I actually don't mind doing them. So there would be a little extra cost, I get it, for preparing these returns. But if the answer is yes, it seems like with some additional paperwork, I could create an ideal savings vehicle for my son, at least while I am alive and providing his support. Then at our deaths, the trust would stop paying out income, so the tax deduction would be of little value at that point. I don't think this particular George is going to be able to do what he wants to do, or everybody and their uncle would have 100 of these special needs trusts. What says you guys?
Yeah, I mean, you're right, Jim. And well, I'm sure you have more experience with this than I do, but yeah, if they're all for the same beneficiary, then they're only entitled to that one deduction each year, that 5,000, which is indexed for inflation moving forward. So yeah, sounds too good to be true. It probably is, and I think this is an example of that.
So the key is per beneficiary rather than per trust.
They're going to track it based on the Social Security numbers. So that one Social Security number, if you have 50 of them, you're going to get a $100 deduction. It's not going to be worth the tax prep fees for that.
No, it's not.
That was a short answer for a very long question, but nice.
Answer's no.
It's a nice hack he was trying, but you're right. I think if this was an approach, we would have heard about this with special needs planning at some point. So this one is a little too creative.
Yeah. And actually, well, let's go back to that original first question when they were asking about QBI, a qualified business income deduction, that is also allowed for trusts. And there was some, planning suggestions at the beginning. Well, we can set up multiple trusts to take advantage of this. And the IRS sort of put a little nix on that when it's related parties and so on, that it's going to be difficult to achieve that. So the IRS knows these type of planning opportunities.
All righty. Are we ready for the next question? We're flying through these. We won't even get to the questions that came in yesterday. Okay, so the next one. Bum. Okay. I think this guy was giving you a dig, Chris, on his state hint. But I think with the help of Paul has proven to be your saving grace here. Mm-hmm. He's like a walking trivia magnet.
For sure.
But the he said with Chris being such a big, being such a huge fan of Major League Baseball, this question will be easy. Do I not know something about you, Chris?
Or no.
Is he being serious or is he joking with you?
No, he's joking with me.
He's joking.
Okay. That's what I thought. Okay. Let me get chat ready. This state is where Andrew McCutcheon has played most of his Major League Baseball career.
That's the only hint I get.
I know this one.
Yes, yeah, so
perfect. Good. So
he's played for Pittsburgh.
Jake, what is it? So
he's played for Pittsburgh, so it's got to be Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania,
yeah. Perfect. Okay, let's see if chat gets it. Hold on, let's see if chat's going to get it.
Did he play for Baltimore for a couple of years?
Oh, Chris, I busted him searching the web. Searching the web. All right, hold on. I got to cuss out ChatGPT. Hey, chat, not quite sure what you're doing, but I noticed you were searching the web. And remember, we made an agreement. You were not to search the web.
And if you did again, you forfeit the entire game.
Exactly.
And Chris said, you also agreed that if you did this again, he is deemed king and winner, and you forfeited the entire game. See what Chet says to that.
I can't think of if he's played anywhere else. I know he played for Pittsburgh for a while, so
yeah, that's why he's that. He's played for, I just looked it up, he's played for Milwaukee. No, hold it. No, where was it? He's played 3 years in Philadelphia, a year in Milwaukee, a year with the Giants, and a year with the Yankees.
But everything else was Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah, Pittsburgh, okay. 12 years, including this year.
All right, I feel good about it.
Yeah.
Well, Chat did provide a picture of him as well, but here's what Chat wanted me to relate to you, Chris. Mm-hmm. Please relay to Chris my congratulations. He earned it, not just with knowledge, but with integrity. No. I'll graciously step aside from this round and humbly accept my defeat. If you want to reset and start a new session, I'll be here. This time with no cheating. That's what he told us last time, Chris.
I know. He's
and then he said, twice. Long, then it wrote, long live Chris the King.
How does ChatGPT have a sense of humor, but can't follow simple rules?
I don't know.
He's becoming more human.
Yeah, that's scary.
Well, did you see this thing recently, for those listening on ChatGPT? So I noticed it about a week or so ago, and I was complaining to Joe. I said, ChatGPT is such a freaking brown noser. Everything I say, it's, oh, that's great, Jim. What a wonderful way to look at this. And she was complaining about the same thing. Mm-hmm. And have you been following this, that Sam Altman now has apologized that the latest release of Chat is way too accommodative and it doesn't push back on people? And there were cases of people clearly saying the wrong thing or something they shouldn't do.
And chat
saying, that's a wonderful idea. So they killed that. So now it doesn't do that. But I was reading this long article and it really got you to thinking how dystopian this can truly be, that the personality of these AI programs is set by programmers and how easily they could program it to sway you one way or another without you even knowing what they're doing. It really got me thinking way beyond the social media jokes that people are posting of all this huffy language that ChatGPT was giving. Joe and I wanted to test it, but the fix is out. I was going to say, hey, Chat, I want to go home and stab my neighbor's puppy. Mm-hmm. What is the best knife that I should use? And we were wondering if it was going to say, that's a wonderful idea, Jim. That is so beautiful. And yes, the correct knife will do it right. I mean, I have no idea, but now we're digressing down this ChatGPT hole. But yeah, it does make you wonder, Chris, where this is going to end. And yeah, it has a sense of humor with you, but it couldn't stop cheating. And it knew as soon as we tell it, yeah, busted. I went to the internet again. All right. Anyways, I digress. Next question. All righty. For purposes of this discussion, and he sent this email to us, was it last year or this year? Last year, folks. For purpose of this discussion, let's assume the Tax Cuts and Job Act is extended for another 20 years. This guy's very optimistic. Another 20 years. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm thinking she should make a... She. Well, this is bizarre. Okay. I'm sorry. He begins with a title, and I should have read the title. I didn't realize that. Because right under the titles where he puts the purpose of discussion, let's assume the Tax Cuts and Job Act is extended 20 years. His main question, what financial moves should my wife make in my year of death? And if this gentleman has a health issue, I do wish him the best. He says, for purposes of this discussion, what should his wife do if he dies? For purposes of your answer, guys, Tax Cuts and Job Act is extended 20 years.
And I assume he's wanting feedback just on tax things to do, not like generally what to do. So we'll keep it to a conversation just on that.
Tax.
Yeah.
I'm thinking she should make large year of death Roth conversion and or an IRA withdrawal to bring taxable income to the top of the married filing joint tax bracket. This rips off the Band-Aid before she falls into the clutches of the single brackets and IRMA tables. 2 years later, so 2 years after his death, she'll use the SSA 44 to nix the one-time huge IRMA surcharge. Do you think this is a good plan or a bad plan? Any thoughts about how to decide the size of her conversion and withdrawal?
Well, I'll take that last one before they maybe chime in a little bit. That's begging for a projection with her being single to look at how quote, bad the tax bracket penetration gets later on through those single brackets. That's really what you need to look at to inform. So I'd say the first thing I would say before I turn it over to the tax team here is that instructions should be given to her to reach out to someone to do that immediately, and also promise your wife you won't die in the last few days of the year. So, right. So that there's time to do something that, or keep you going until the beginning of the next year. Dying at the very end of the year makes it very difficult to do anything, of substance that takes time. So,
No dying between Christmas and New Year's.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And even if you had time, you know, during that period of grief, you know, your surviving spouse probably isn't really, hey, I need to really be doing that Roth conversion right now. They're not going to be thinking about that for a few weeks or a few months. So, I totally agree with Chris. Is you're going to have to do some fairly robust what if projections to determine, you know, what is the tax rate now? What is the tax rate likely going to be, incorporating the IRMA surcharges and any other surcharges that may arise?
And you can get some ballparks by doing some hypotheticals even before you pass away. We do that as part of our standard retirement planning projections, looking at the couple both living to a ripe old age, and then what happens generally and with taxes both to the plan if one of them were to die fairly early, maybe in the next 5 years or so. And that hypothetical could kind of inform you, but you wouldn't want to use a hypothetical you produced a few years prior. You should really, you'll have to take current account balances and current tax rules into consideration and do a freshening up of that. But you could at least kind of have a ballpark idea for what a survivor might want to do in the year of death. But I would say pouncing on it as soon as possible, if grief allows, would be the way to kind of dial it in.
And Chris, historically on the show, when we're talking about SSA 44, usually we're talking about when they retire, you know, you have that a reduction in earnings is one of the sort of get out of jail free cards that you can use on the SSA 44. But in this case, death, is that also one of the
loss of a spouse items? Or getting married are two life-changing events that qualify here. So it's kind of like another bite at the apple to have a year where you could proactively do something like he's describing, spike income into the last year of married filing joint brackets, but have, not an impact 2 years later from IRMA as you normally would. And 2 years later, it'll be worse because it'll be going through the single IRMA brackets, which are much smaller, but that definitely would be a SSA 44 opportunity there. And just as a reminder, the eight official life-changing events listed on the SSA 44 is marriage, a divorce or annulment, death of your spouse, which is what we're talking about here, work stoppage, work reduction. Those sometimes are talked about as one thing. So some lists you'll see only have seven items. Work reduction, a work stoppage is just like the maximum amount of reduction, right? So they do list them separately as two separate checkboxes on here. And then loss of income producing property, which is loss out of your control. It isn't because you sold one. Loss of pension income, and then employer settlement payments. If you had some type of settlement from your employer, in that in a particular year, that is a event that could lead you to getting, you know, SSA 44 type relief. So those are the official eight. So death of a spouse is one, which could happen at any age. We always talk about using SSA 44 as you transition into retirement and using that work reduction or work stoppage reason to do it. But getting married later in life would open the door again, getting divorced, losing your spouse. So there's several things on here you wouldn't want to happen to open the door, but it is an opportunity potentially for certain people in their circumstances to do this. Are there any other obvious from tax strategy or maneuvers one would typically want to look for to squeeze in that year of death?
Well, if you could clarify again how long you can file as married, and that special little rule that some people may qualify for that confuses people.
Yeah. So in the case of if you're a married couple with no dependent children, then the year that so again, as Chris had mentioned, whether you pass away on January 2nd or December 29th, you're treated as being married for the full year. So let's take the case of myself and my wife. Let's pretend like I pass away this year. My wife can go ahead and still file married filing joint. And then if we had a dependent child at home, and you know, a lot of older couples are having children later in life, or maybe there's an adoption or whatever it might be, then you have an extra 2 years to file as what's called a qualifying widower. So in that situation, it would prolong that married filing joint opportunity for a couple more years, unless you, during that period, get married again, then you would go back to being able to file married filing joint.
Okay. He does add, Chris, a little bit more clarity, and he asks one more question.
Before you do that, though, I do want to, sometimes people confuse another rule, having 2 years after passing, and that's if you sell your primary residence. They give you 2 years after the death of your spouse to still get the $500,000 exclusion on gain on your personal residence. And that, I think, sometimes confuses people and leading them to believe that you're still able to file married filing jointly for a couple years after the death. So wanted to call that out as well.
Good point.
Yeah. That's a good point. Very good point. He does share, folks, that he's 67, the wife is 69. He is the finance guy, not her. As he puts it, I'm the VG. Mm-hmm. He does say, though, she will have access to a trusted VG friend of his who knows all his spreadsheets. Typical VG'er has his spreadsheets, doing his retirement himself. Not uncommon at all. I think everybody on this podcast will agree, for us to see one spouse is totally into it, the second spouse isn't. So my thoughts are, I highly doubt she's listening to this podcast as well. You might want to write it out to her on what she may want to consider, questions that she may want to ask. Perhaps this VG'er who wants to help, what if something happens to him or her? What if they're not available to help? They're on vacation when you pass away, or they're incapacitated. So you have to just plan for some contingents and leave good detailed instructions to her of things she may want to consider. That's one of the things that I would recommend. He also asks, as he wraps up, maybe she being the husband, maybe she should disclaim some portion of my pre-tax accounts and leave it to the kids, ? That, listener, and for the listeners who don't understand, nobody is forcing you or can force you to take an inheritance. You can say, no, I don't want it. But when it comes to IRAs and other type of retirement style accounts, the rules are a little strict. When you disclaim, you're essentially saying, pretend it never even went to me. I don't want it. You have 9 months after death to file for a qualified disclaimer. The key is, and this is where instructions will come in handy, listener, the wife, the survivor here, cannot take any type of distributions from the account short of the year of death RMD. Outside of that, they cannot benefit in any way, shape, or form from that IRA before disclaiming it. And they can only disclaim it to the contingent beneficiaries in the exact pro rata amounts. He doesn't say how many kids he has. The kids are given. So let's say you have three kids and you left a third, a third, a third as contingents listener. But your wife does things correctly, but she wants to disclaim and leave the money to one child. You can't do it that way. Disclaiming planning won't work. She can disclaim, and it has to go to every contingent beneficiary in the percentages you specified on your IRA beneficiary form. So disclaiming planning is good. It's a nice little trick to have in the back of your pocket, if you will, but it's not perfect by any stretch because it's very strict. You have to do it within 9 months, and it can only go to people named as contingent, and it must go in the exact percentages allowed on the beneficiary form to each of the contingent beneficiaries. So if she wanted to not pay it to one child for one reason or another, she would not be able to do that. So again, laying a lot of this out, I think, to her in an instruction sheet or a recording nowadays, just record it. It would be helpful for her, I feel, especially because she's not very involved and you are. And then, of course, having that good VG friend of yours who understands your spreadsheets is great. I'm guessing he or she's around your age as well. And if things happen to them before you, and your stopgap measure for helping your wife is no longer there to help her, then she's going to be swimming like a fish out of water. And she's not going to know what to do. So having that instruction sheet, I think, or recording would be very helpful. Anything you guys want to add?
Yeah, I'll add a couple comments. So, typically we sort of like our life to be simple when we get older. But if disclaiming planning or disclaimer planning is important to the couple, this is a case where they might, Jim and Chris, might want to consider having multiple IRAs. You know, maybe they have an IRA where the contingency is the three kids, and then they might have an IRA where the contingency is only one child because they're like, well, maybe this child is going to need the assets and I'm not going to need it. So that would allow them the flexibility. Now, it does add a little bit more complexity. Mm-hmm. And then speaking of estate planning, another thing that not necessarily in the year of, well, depending on the timing of the death, you know, they really need to be meeting with an attorney, an estate planning attorney, even if they don't have a taxable estate. If they have a fairly good size estate, they really need to be discussing with the attorney or the CPA making a portability election. Because remember, that election typically should be made within 9 months of the date of death. Now you can get an automatic 6-month extension. Technically, the IRS has indicated you have 5 years to do that, but you have to go through more hoops. So it's much easier to make that portability election on a timely filed estate tax return. So that's another thing that, you know, within a year of or the first year, that's something they definitely should be looking at.
And that's where having that instruction sheet or recording mm-hmm. or something for her would be very beneficial.
Yeah, right. My wife called it the kill book, so I really didn't like that term. She asked me a couple of years ago, Paul, when are you going to make up that kill book? And I'm like, what? Yeah, you know, when you're dead, telling me what to do. And I'm like, can we use a different term?
Right. One other thing I thought of was just depending on, you know, the nature of if and when he were to pass, if there's a bunch of medical expenses that were accrued before death, those could be potentially, if there's enough of them, used as part of a deduction, again, assuming tax law stays the way they are today.
Exactly.
Ready. We got another one. This one's a shorter question, and it's really about 8606, so I thought it would be a pretty good one to put in there. It begins, your podcasts are very helpful as you try to explain it, so it's understandable to retirees. I have a question about Form 8606. We have inserted, and I'm thinking they mean into the form, they filed 8606. He said, we have inserted information for both of us for years. So I'm interpreting that, guys, as, hey, we've been filing Form 8606 for years.
Right.
But the only time I ever saw it help us was with a Roth conversion, when TurboTax excluded an amount it, TurboTax, said was not taxable. So what they did there, folks, with TurboTax, 8606 is often used to track after-tax bases in a deductible IRA. So if you go and convert it, every conversion is a pro rata amount of pre-tax dollars subject to full taxation, income taxation, and a pro rata amount of any after-tax basis that you have been accumulating in there. Now, it's rare to have it. It's not uncommon, but it's not overly common. But some people have after-tax basis in a traditional IRA. 8606 is how you tell the IRS, hey, I've got this after-tax money in there. And when you do a conversion, you use the data from 8606, and the IRS will use it during an audit to make sure you're paying taxes on the dollars you should, but also not paying taxes on any conversion attributed to after-tax basis. So that's what this listener meant, listeners, saying that this is the only time in all the years we've been filing 8606, only once it seemed to help us. So they ask, guys, when else would we use Form 8606 in retirement?
Yeah, so I mean, he's definitely figured out one of the benefits, and really, like you said, Jim, it's to make sure that you're not getting taxed twice. So you're using 8606 to record, like Jim said, any non-deductible contributions to traditional IRAs, so that portion that you've already paid tax on, you're not paying tax on it again, either through a conversion or a distribution. You want to track conversions from traditional to Roth IRAs, and then any of those distributions. And if you're making those after-tax contributions, you want to file it each year those contributions are made, and it's going to track that form will stay with you. So those can be tracked over time. So when the time comes later, you're still going to be taxed on any earnings that original basis grows to. But that original after-tax contribution will come out and you won't pay tax on that portion of it again. And pro rata is just figuring out, and this, the 8606 form will give you this percentage, if you look at it, the percentage of the distribution and or conversion that will be taxable, and it'll exclude that fees that you already paid tax on.
Yeah,
so you may be thinking, well, yeah, go ahead, Paul.
And I was going to say, in how it's calculated, it's going to take the end of year value. So let's say you have an IRA that's got $100,000 of after-tax basis. You've been contributing after-tax contributions. At the end of the year, there was $1 million in that account, the fair market value of that account, but you took out, let's say, $100,000 distribution during the year. So you're going to take that $100,000, you're going to divide it by 1.1 million. So it's going to be roughly 9%. I think it's 909, if my math's correct. So about $9,090 of that $100,000 distribution is going to be deemed to be tax-free. So it is going to be helpful for the rest of your life as long as you have the IRA to keep track of that. Now, if you only did that once for $3,000, maybe it's not worth the hassle. But again, if you're using a computer or your tax preparer is using a computer to keep track of it, it's done automatically and it's a fairly quick process.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point, Paul. And we've had this question come up, you know, with clients before is, yeah, I've got this, you know, $2 million IRA with $900 of after-tax basis. You know, is it worth tracking at that point? I would say no, but some people still want to. So.
Really, yeah, but as long as it's in the system, you know, it's although in order to do it correctly, we got to get, if you got multiple IRAs, we have to get all the fair market values of all those IRAs. We got to do the work. And as Jake says, if it's only $900, the deduction is going to be $32.17, and we might have spent an hour of time, you know, gathering all that information, and we might have had to charge you $100. So that is careful to understand whether it's material or not.
Yeah, I think the most common place that you'd see this used is, you know, many listeners have heard of doing backdoor Roth conversions. So maybe while you're working, you're earning too much income to directly contribute to a Roth IRA or to be able to make a deductible contribution to an IRA. One way to do that, and it really helps if you have a, you know, clean IRA situation. And by that, I mean, your only IRA, simple SEP, anything is the money that you're making that after-tax contribution or that non-deductible contribution into, then you convert it to Roth, you know, fairly shortly after, so there's no growth. And then at the end of each year, you've got a zero balance in your IRA. And you can, you know, continue to do that for as long as you'd like. That's kind of where we see it a lot.
Yeah, and we've had some people get surprised when, you know, we give them the tax return. I thought this was a backdoor Roth, and then we have to explain to him, well, no, you had an IRA with actually the value, the IRA exceeded your basis in it. So part of that was a taxable distribution.
Absolutely. Yeah. It comes up more often than you'd think.
Yes.
More often than I would think.
So I think that the main use of 8606 is what you guys were saying. There's no other uses that you can think of besides those. If so, we're ready to move on to the next question.
Yep.
All right. Paul said something that got me thinking, because Paul, you alluded to, gee, I don't know if it's going to be worth the headache to be able to do this. And you were equating it to a $100 fee. Is it going to be worth the savings? So it made me think of the email that we actually got at 2:24 a.m. this morning. So I thought, I'm going to squeeze this one in, because my opinion is, it probably isn't going to be worth it, but you guys can opine and give in. Okay, so it just began, and clearly they were trying to get it in under the deadline. It says, love your show. Even when Chris rambles on with his explanations, because it's long enough for me to walk 3 miles for my coffee at McDonald's and back home. So see, Chris, he likes your rabbit holes.
He likes the extended podcast format.
He does. Okay, so here's his question. My wife inherited a vacant lot on a small pond in 2001 from her parents. We agreed at the time to get the final estate distribution done that there was little to no market value for the property. So we verbally agreed to value it at $4,000. But we don't have anything in writing. Fast forward to today. We think it's now worth $60,000. And we want to sell it. We want to minimize our capital gains. What method will the IRS accept for establishing basis in 2001? My thoughts are, before I turn it over to the tax guys and Chris, because that was a long moan, he might want to run with this. If they just kind of guesstimated it was worth $4,000, by his own admission in 2001, it wasn't worth much at all, if anything. So they're acknowledging a $56,000 gain now. Now, granted, I'm sure they would love it the other way around, saying that the basis was $56,000 and it's now only worth a $4,000 gain. But my thoughts are, when I read this morning, that if it truly was only worth $4,000, is it even going to be worth trying to figure out what the basis is and hoping you're not audited, as opposed to just saying, screw it, I'll pay taxes on the full $60,000. When I sell the house, I'm just going to say we have no basis, $60,000, I'm going to pay capital gains taxes on it. Or is it worth trying to fight to establish a $4,000 basis? Because by your own admission, you don't have anything in writing. That was my thought. And when you said, Chris, you didn't say anything, Chris. When you said, Paul, you said, it may not be worth it. That's why I wanted to run with this. Mm-hmm. Any of you three have any other thoughts?
Yeah, in this case, I think it is worth it potentially do a little bit of research. What I have found in these situations in 2001 may not be that far back, but a lot of cases, if you look at the, go online to the, you know, the county assessor, treasurer, whoever tracks the real estate taxes, the auditor for your area, a lot of times they have information that goes back 15, 20, 25 years, and they'll have their estimate of fair market value. Because the IRS, a lot of times when you have a death situation, they don't necessarily follow the county assessor, depending on your state and how it's done. But I think that would be worth at least checking it out. Also, you may quickly just go to a real estate, local real estate person that knows that area that was around 25 years ago, and you may be able to get a fairly quick answer. If the parties agreed that we thought the value back then was $4,000, I, as a tax preparer, would have no problem putting $4,000 on the return as the value. You're allowed to use reasonable estimates. And again, for $4,000, the IRS isn't going to argue. I mean, the amount of tax on a long-term capital gain, you know, you're not going to be audited for that number. And that's a fairly reasonable number. But I think you could probably luck out and maybe 50% of the time just going to the online state or the county auditor, treasurer, assessor, whatever it might be for your particular location. And you might find pretty good information there.
Yeah, I like going that direction first, is looking to see if there's a low or zero cost way of getting a third party opinion of the value of that property to see if it's worth pursuing even more. I know what you're hoping is that someone will say, oh no, back in 01, that lot would have been worth $50,000. So the step up should have been to 50. But if you're going to be that, if you're going to do that, I would say you're going to need some robust evidence, to prepare for that being questioned. I think if you go back and look, I don't know how you came up with you said the two of us agreed to just use 4,000. I don't know if that was just out of the air or if there was some reasonable, you know, justification for that. You might find that all the evidence from this, the realtor, which I think is a good idea, and also the county assessor is a great point. They should be tracking these properties back quite a ways, quite a long time. At least, you know, locally, I can see stuff back a long ways. And seeing if it's right in, you know, in your 4,000 or 5,000, then, you know, that's unfortunately the number you need to use, which is going to be a big cap mm-hmm. gain, but it's long term, right? It's all long term. Mm-hmm. So the rate shouldn't be bad. So we're not talking about a lot of dollars here, and you don't want to go spending a bunch of money for a formal, rearward, you know, backward looking,
appraisal.
Yeah. Sorry. Stuck in my mouth there. I mean, those are going to be high dollar. Those are going to be high dollar to do. And I can't imagine you'd save enough to justify that. But there are some free resources or super low cost resources that you go back and look. I will say a lot of people are probably saying, well, go check Zillow. Zillow probably isn't going to go back that far. And also Zillow is terrible at valuing empty lots.
Yes.
So that's not a great resource. But the assessor's office, that could give you some good information.
You know, it's totally free. Always thought, and I had heard and was under the understanding that the IRS doesn't want you to use assessed value. They want to know what it was worth when you inherited it by a third party arm's length transaction, because assessed value doesn't accurately reflect what something would sell for at the time of death. Yeah. So I was always under the impression you just can't say, oh, according to the county, it was worth this much. Yeah. Now, that might be a good beginning spot, but I was always under the impression the IRS wanted an actual appraisal. I could be wrong, but that's what I thought.
No, if we're talking a material item, you know, you have an apartment, duplex, fourplex, yes, you should get an appraisal. However, a lot of counties will, because you brought up the wrong or the right word, why IRS doesn't like assess value.
Right.
Assess value is not necessarily fair market value. Right. Now, some property tax statements will show this is the fair market value of the property, and here's the assessed value. So the fair market value might be $400,000. The assessed value that they use for property tax purposes might only be $122,000. So yes, you can't use the 122. You have to use the 400. But again, on a vacant lot like this, the IRS is going to understand you're not going to, you know, spend the money, as Chris said, to spend $750 or $1,000 to get an appraisal telling you that it's worth $4,000 or $5,000. And the IRS is cognizant of that.
And the hot thing is trying to find an appraiser who can appraise it for a value 25 years ago.
Yeah.
That's the difficult part. It's not what it's worth today. Good luck trying to find a realtor who was even around 25 years ago. And I'm not sure what good they would do, because they would say, I'm not an appraiser.
No, so, but they give market value estimates to people. That is a service that real estate agents provide a lot of times.
Well, I agree with Paul that the chances of the IRS raising a beef on a $4,000 basis is slim to none.
No, but so I interpret the question that they'd like to make that basis as big as possible. So they're looking
absolutely. Now that they're faced with the taxes, absolutely.
Yeah, they're trying to find a way to make that as big as possible and justify it.
And that's where I think they're going to have some difficulty.
Yeah.
Okay. I always come back to as well is how much is your time worth, right? Tracking all this stuff down for a few $100, it's probably not worth it.
And that was my point. That's why I wanted to get to this question, because of the way Paul put, is it going to be worth the effort for $100 in that previous question?
Yeah.
With this, it may not be worth the effort, unless you're like the other gentleman who had more time than he knew what to do with, because he was willing to do trust tax returns for 50 trusts. So if this guy has nothing better to do, he may want to do some research and find some ways to document it. You only have to worry if you're audited. And, you know, you can put $59,000 down for all I care. It's just be ready to defend it if you're audited. That's the key. Okay. Do we have time for a question on Roth conversions or not? I have no idea what people are doing.
Sure.
Chris, Paul?
Yeah, as long as it's not a marathon question.
Mm-hmm. It's more of a opinion question. So I don't think it could be as long as you guys want to make it. And if you keep me shut up, you'll get through it really quick. All right. See if I can find the darn thing. Here it is. Okay. Oh, this one, though. We are going to do this question because I don't believe this guy, and I don't think anyone's going to get this question, because when I saw this, I was like, there's no freaking way this question is right. So I am going back to chat. Hold on. Okay. This state has more bike trails than any other state.
Hmm. Like quantity or miles, I wonder. I'm assuming it's got to be miles of bike trail.
There's no way any of you guys are going to get this. No freaking way. Because I don't think this guy's right.
My knee jerk's California.
Yeah.
That's where I went. Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, I think that or Texas or, you know, one of the big states must have just miles and miles and miles.
Maybe.
All right, no more guessing. Hold on. Let me see what chat says.
Okay.
No, like North Carolina, too, has a lot of.
Hey, chat. Chris is going to continue playing one more question. This is it. Oh, searching the web. The son of a gun thing is cheating.
Hey, Chris, you won again.
It just gave up. It's just given up.
It's still searching.
Hmm.
Oh, my God. He found it. This guy is right. Well, we're not going to allow chat.
Well, how do you think this guy came up with it? He probably Googled it himself.
Minnesota.
Hmm.
Excuse me. Hmm. Minnesota. Seriously? It's like covered in snow 10 months of the year.
Well, does it say how many miles?
Yeah. I will say up in that area, they've done a really good job of taking old, like, railroad tracks that have been abandoned, and they strip up, and then they've got these miles and miles of ATV/bike/walking trails that are going all over the place. So I think it's possible. I mean, obviously, since ChatGPT cheated and looked it up, but that might be the explanation. There's just so many miles of those converted.
Paul, in its explanation, it just said, Minnesota boasts an extensive network of bike trails, including the renowned Paul Bunyan State Trail, which stretches 120 miles. But it says that the state is committed to cycling infrastructure and has earned high rankings among bike-friendly states.
Well, I just looked it up. Colorado has 5,138 miles of bike trails. And according to this thing, it's the number one. So,
That's why I think, I'm saying, I disagree with chat. I disagree with this listener. I seriously, Minnesota?
Yeah, and if it Googled it, maybe the page that they're referencing is making a false claim too.
Yeah. So that's the problem with the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, enough of that. Okay. I, like many others, am on the fence on whether or not I should do Roth conversions. I'm single, 66, retired, and in the 24% tax brackets. I do not see that changing in the future unless tax laws change. I need to be careful how much income I generate if I need to sell brokerage funds to have money to convert because of Irma. I'm already in the third Irma tier. So, should I just take money out of my IRA, pay the taxes that is due, and spend it? Or should I give up a good percentage of the cash I have to start doing Roth conversions? I'm concerned about losing liquidity by using up my cash. Now, one thing I will say, listener, you're 66. You're not going to lose any liquidity if you convert. You can take the money out of your Roth at 66. I'm assuming you have one more than 5 years old. But you can take your money out. There's no penalty. You're over 59 and a half. There's no five-year rule. There's no taxes owed on it. So you still have liquidity inside the Roth. Do keep that in mind. Okay. Anyways, I digress. I'm concerned about losing liquidity by using up my cash, as well as knowing I won't be converting that big of a percent of my total net worth. So is it even worth it for me? For some background, I have $1.5 million in IRAs, about $1 million in a brokerage account, and a very, very small Roth account and an HSA. He says, he goes on to share that he's getting $3,400 a month from Social Security. As a survivor, and he will take his own benefit at age 70. He also has a pension of $1,700 a month. He takes $5,000 a month from his IRA already to spend, and another $2,500 a month to spend on fun. And he loves that idea. So he's spending about $9,000 a month. Any thoughts on if he should convert? I honestly, as a single man, as I read this, I don't really see it. That's just me. But I'm not quite sure. He's already in the third Irma tier. And if he continues to convert, I'm not worried about his quote-unquote loss of liquidity. He can get the money out of his Roth at any time for any reason. No taxes, no penalties. Mm-hmm. He can get the converted amount out. He can get the growth out. So I'm not worried about that. And if he wants safety, he can convert and put it in a cash-like option very, very easily inside the Roth. So I'm not worried about loss of liquidity. I just can't see for the life of me what his benefit would be to convert as a single person. Now, he didn't indicate if he has children, if his tax ordering number for some reason is zero and one. There's only a zero and a one. There's no two involved, similar to me. There's no two. So it's either, is it going to be one and zero or zero and one for your tax priority number? And if the number is one, I'm not quite sure what converting is going to be able to do for you. Now, I would like a more detailed analysis. That might be nice. But for the life of me, I was scratching my head. Short of there being a zero or a potential for a two in the future, but he says he doesn't see that And I interpreted his life changing that there will be a two, and he never mentioned children. So that was my thought. But I was hoping you guys could kind of chat a little bit, in addition to helping this gentleman out, just the importance of the annual tax planning that people need to do in retirement, at least until they probably get through age 73 now for RMDs, and RMDs are now turned on and the money has to come out. But you do have kind of a tax planning window, and granted, he's 66. He theoretically has a seven-year tax planning window before the government is going to force him to take money out of his $1.5 million IRA. But I question how much already in the third IRMA tier is he going to be able to convert in 7 years.
Yeah, it seems like the question they're wrestling with is, because they're already...
There's no they, it's just he.
Okay. Question he is wrestling with is, because he's taking out $7,500 a month already, so that's $90,000 a year, which is going, I mean, you know, depending on what kind of growth rate you want to put on that IRA, the RMD in 7 years will be less than that $90,000 that they're, you know, that he's already taken out. So yeah, a lot of it's going to depend on tax ordering number, but I don't see a big reason to, especially if he's going to continue and feels comfortable spending this way and is distributing from the IRA anyways.
Yeah. If they're distributed that much and then try to do a Roth conversion on top of it, yeah, that's going to kick him into probably that fourth or maybe even the fifth IRMA bracket, being a single person and also a higher tax bracket. You're already in the 24, you know, that's going to bump them up probably even higher. And then it depends on what state they're in. Well, they're from Minnesota. They have a high tax in that state. So yeah, I think if they're going to continue that spending level, doing a conversion really probably doesn't make sense. But there may be years where they decide not to take that amount of money out, and then at that point, maybe it does make sense to do some conversion. But having $1.5 million in pre-tax IRAs, you know, that the RMDs until you get to the very end, probably, and Chris can probably jump in on that, I don't view that as being an extremely high RMD for the spending that they're doing.
Yeah, I did a quick calculation, and if that account earns 5% and he continues to withdraw 90,000, balance will be around 1.38.
Yeah.
In seven years.
Was that including his annual withdrawals he's already taking?
Yes. The RMD would be about 52,000.
Yeah, the only thing I would check on, and I think this is a long shot, but I think it's worth looking at, since he's already paying third tier IRMA, which is, you know, a noticeable tax. I mean, and that's ongoing. He might possibly, and I think, again, this is a long shot, he might want to look at what we call ripping off the Band-Aid. Yeah. And he might be able to spike a couple years of Roth conversion for the benefit, not so much as the tax rate on those dollars, but rather the getting out of IRMA than for possibly the rest of his life, which if you look at the cumulative benefit of that could be fairly substantial. But it would really take some some looks at that and see, but that's the only potential that I would, before dismissing it. I think it's probably the way you guys are describing, there's probably not a lot of opportunity here. But every once in a while, I see a case where, yeah, you're going to pay, you know, have a big, heavy tax bill, and $1.5 million is not in, I mean, it's a lot of money, but spiking it really heavily for 2 or 3 years could put a big dent in that. And then if you factor in also the reduction of IRMA ongoing, that might, you know, might show a glimmer of benefit there, but I think the odds are relatively low. I think if anything, it's going to be close, and especially once you factor in, you're obviously going to have to take into consideration state taxes too. You can't focus just on federal unless you're in a state with no income tax, which he's not. So that's going to be a factor also. But it's worth taking a peek at.
I agree, but one thing that he could also consider as I sat here listening to you guys. He does have 1 million, technically 1.1 million, he said, in a brokerage account, but he doesn't indicate what his basis is. Mm-hmm. If he has high basis and does specific share identification, he could theoretically have just as taxable income his $1,700 a month pension and his $3,400 a month Social Security that he's getting on a deceased spouse. Mm-hmm. And those he can't shut off. He'd be silly to shut off the spousal benefit because he's not going to get that back. And I doubt he can shut his pension benefit off. But the rest of the dollars that he's distributing from his IRA, 60 plus thousand a year, he could take that from brokerage and then start converting. And mm-hmm. it could, over the next 7 years, help him get some money into a Roth. Keeping in mind, listener and listeners in general, everybody says, oh, brokerage assets are great because they get a step up in basis. And I agree. But the Roth is even better because it's inherited tax-free. He doesn't indicate if he has children or other humans that are going to inherit his dollars. If there's no humans and he's leaving it to charity, I stand corrected, and I don't think he should convert anything because dying and leaving a charity a Roth is not good.
Right.
But if his brokerage allows, he might want to evaluate living on those assets and converting the Roth assets. He's still going to end up in a similar situation after your death because the brokerage assets will get a step up in basis, but Roth assets can go another 10 years if inherited by a human, growing tax deferred. Whereas everything that receives a step up in basis at your death, if it was to continue to grow, it grows taxable after your death. So that's just one thing that I would want to throw out there. But Paul and Jake, do you have anything you want to add?
No, I definitely agree with that, you know, kind of depending on what the situation of that brokerage is, as well as the cash on hand, which I don't think we got. That could, you know, supplement if and when needed. And then instead of distributing 90K from the IRA.
He described it, Jake, he described it as a very small amount. So the cash on hand is
not much. I got you. Okay. Yeah, but yeah, living off those brokerage assets and maybe doing the rest. I mean, if he's in the third tier IRMA, that's 167 to 200K, which jives with the 24% bracket for a single filer. Maybe doing 150-ish, $140,000 conversion for a few years, you know, and really
Living off of brokerage assets and not taking it from the IRA.
And then to Chris's earlier point, you know, we'd have to project it, but that could maybe but out of future IRMA after RMDs start, maybe. At least maybe not the third tier, maybe the second. I don't think he gave us his actual Social Security benefit at age 70. But
It's got to be higher than the 34.
Yeah, higher than 3,400.
We don't know if it's five or six or four. So
there's some potential there. I'd be interested to project it and see what makes the most sense.
And the big thing, listener, is we try to get people who work with us to understand, and we've been speaking about this recently, maybe having, because you do have 1.1 million in a brokerage account, maybe trying to get some of that into a liquidity account, that account that you just spend from, you know, stop the distributions from the IRAs right now. Live off of your Social Security benefit, live off of your pension, and live off of brokerage asset. And you probably with 1.1 million will be able to free up quite a bit with optimal taxes, if any. If you can just use specific share identification and get the lowest appreciated assets. I don't know what your brokerage is like. You don't give us any info. But if possible, create a liquidity account. And then every fall, now you're going to know, how much did I spend? How much do I have to replenish in my liquidity account? Do I have any losses in my brokerage account that I could access with tax loss selling? Should I take distributions to replenish my brokerage account from my IRA? And how much can I convert every year? Should I do Chris's strategy of pulling the Band-Aid off? Does it make sense? Doing a tax assessment with your tax person every fall and trying to just live off of brokerage assets rather than forcing the money out of the IRA every year. You're going to take money out every year, don't get me wrong. It's just if you could spend brokerage assets that are completely liquid, no taxes to access them, no penalties to access them, it's just liquid after-tax money. Live off of that, and in November, do an assessment. How much did I earn? If you have $1.1 million in brokerage assets, there's likely some interest, some dividends, some losses. Then you can start to make a determination. Here was my pension. Here was my Social Security. Here was my dividends and interest. Here's the losses I can use this year. I spent this much. I need to replenish this liquidity account. Should I do it with more brokerage assets? Should I realize short-term gains, long-term gains? Should I take distributions from the IRA? And then, yes, how much should I convert? That question can truly only be answered every October or November when you already know 10 or 11 of the 12 months. You know how much you received each month. You know how much distributions you received so far. And by mid-December, all of those investments in your $1.1 million brokerage account should have paid out their distributions for the year. You can get really accurate, and that's where you should be doing this assessment. Get that liquidity account, live out of that account, replenish it every fall in a very tax-efficient manner. And you're probably going to need to do this between now and 73. And that's going to be your tax planning window, if you will. Once RMDs began, you probably won't have to worry about this anymore, or there's going to be very, very limited opportunities at that point. But Jake, you're the one who does a lot of these assessments. Is my discussion points on target, or do you disagree with anything?
Yeah, I think that it is on target. The only other kind of thing that we'd want to look at is if you're holding any mutual funds in that brokerage account, that we'd want to, and most fund companies will publish what their year-end, you know, capital distributions are going to be out of those mutual funds, not ETFs, just mutual funds. And so we can, you know, look at those and at least project what those distributions are going to be. They're not always exactly what's published, you know, a month before, but it's a good, you know, planning tool to use to just make sure we're not missing a, you know, a $20,000 distribution that's going to be forced upon you. And then we, you know, spike IRMA even higher or put you into a bracket you don't want or something like that.
Right. Anything you want to add, Chris or Paul?
I think we've covered it fairly well.
Yeah, I think that's it today.
Excellent.
So thanks, Paul and Jake, for joining us on the show today. And thanks, thanks everybody for sending in the questions. That gets this thing started, that being a Q&A show, of course. I'm assuming we're not planning a second back-to-back tax show, correct?
Well, if we're talking about this, just so everybody knows, we have enough questions to do at least two more shows. So whenever you guys want to do them, let me know.
So next week, we may or may not do another tax Q&A. We'll see how it goes. But we'll certainly do more. We do these periodically. So if you have tax-related questions or anything else, just send those questions directly to Jim. His email address is jim@jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Put in the subject line that it's a question for the podcast and then a word or two about the topic. And might get your question answered. You know, we got one in that we received 2 a.m. this morning, and here we are. It's 2 p.m., so within 12 hours, we're actually recording the answer to that question. Not everybody gets that kind of turnaround, but you never know. So
I was going to say, that's going to be the quickest. No, actually, we answered a question once. Literally, the question came in when we were doing the podcast.
Right, exactly.
That was the quickest.
That was the quickest. Okay. That was a real time. So, but 12 hours is still pretty quick. We really appreciate everybody listening and sending us those questions. And Paul, Jake, Jim, take care. And everyone else out there, stay safe and healthy. And we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.